Take your Bibles this morning. Turn to Micah chapter 3. Micah chapter 3. You can use one of the pew Bibles in front of you if you don't have one of your own. We're going to be studying this chapter this morning. As I was preparing the message for today from this chapter of Micah, I was thinking about injustice and the ways that we see injustice in our world. And as it happens, I was walking the dog and I was listening to a podcast from NPR. Do you guys listen to NPR at all? Any NPR folks? Good. I like NPR and I like a lot of the podcasts that they spin off. There's one called More Perfect, which talks about the Supreme Court. Just the history of the Supreme Court, important decisions from the Supreme Court, and some well-known cases that you've heard about, some really obscure ones that you never heard about, but that have a big impact on our lives. And I was listening to one this week. They were talking about the Dred Scott case. Familiar with that? The Dred Scott case? Dred Scott, around the 1830s. This was a very important case in our country's history. This was the case in which the Supreme Court ruled that black Americans are not really citizens of the country, or at least not such that they have the same rights as white Americans. Okay. So this was the 1830s. This is part of the precursor that led up eventually, of course, to the Civil War. In the 1860s. But the podcast I was listening to was talking about that case. Dred Scott was a slave of a white man. They went up to, I think it was Minnesota, and being there in a northern state, Dred Scott sued for his freedom, and that's what led to this famous case. But as I was listening to the podcast, they were talking not just about the history of the Dred Scott case, but they were also talking about an event that happened just a couple of years ago in a hotel ballroom in Annapolis, Maryland, where the descendants of Dred Scott and the descendants of Roger Taney, who was the Supreme Court justice in the Dred Scott case, got together. And they what they called it was a reconciliation conference. And the descendants of Taney and the descendants of Dred Scott talked things out. And they just talked about their histories, their family histories, things that their families had been through, their parents and grandparents. And they talked about our country's history and just all of the racial divisions that we have. Nothing big was decided there. I mean, it's just two families, basically, who got together and talked about things. But in the course of this conference, as they called it, one of the men who kind of was an unofficial spokesperson for the Taney family stood up on a stage and he said, "Look, I don't know what value there is in one person apologizing for something that another person did, but to the extent that that has any value, I want to say from the Taney family to the Scott family, we're sorry. We're sorry that this happened." And I thought that was really interesting, just people trying to deal with the injustices of our culture, of our country. And the other thing I found interesting about that whole situation was that at the beginning of that conference where the descendants of Roger Taney and the descendants of Dred Scott got together, at the beginning of that conversation, a minister got up behind the pulpit and said a prayer of blessing on their time together. And obviously, I don't know what the religious background of either of those families is or individuals within those families. But I thought it was telling that when we deal with some of the worst injustices in our culture, it's almost reflex for us to turn to religion, isn't it? It's almost reflex for us to turn to the comfort of the Bible or of the church or of clergy, because we realize that injustice is something that's just much bigger than us. It's much bigger than us. And we also realize that injustice is something that in and of ourselves, we're not going to be able to deal with. We try to deal with it. And we try hard, and so we should. We should try hard to deal with injustice, to protect the vulnerable from injustice, and to safeguard justice in our culture. We should pass laws. We should do what we can for justice. But no matter what we do for it, it seems like we just always have this problem with injustice. We always seem to have this problem with injustice. And as I was reading Micah 3 in preparation for this morning, I realized Micah has the same problem that we have. The problems that Micah was facing in ancient Israel, Judah, they are similar to ours. He was also dealing with an injustice that seemed like it was never going to go away. It was an injustice that needed something stronger to deal with it than just laws and legislation and things like that. It needed something bigger, something stronger, because it was more deeply rooted than just outward behaviors. And so what I want to suggest to you this morning as we get into Micah chapter 3 is that wrong treatment of people, which is another way of talking about injustice, right? Wrong treatment of people always proceeds out of a wrong view of God. That may seem like a stretch, but I hope that we're going to be able to get there in the course of our time together this morning. A wrong view of God will always produce the wrong treatment of people. Therefore, the only way to decisively correct the treatment of people is to correct our view of God. That's what I think Micah has to tell us in this chapter today. Micah is as disgusted by the injustice of his culture as we are at the injustice of ours. And he sees at its root a false idea of God. He sees false prophets in his country. He sees bullying leaders. We talked about that last week. And because of them, there is injustice. And at the root of it is this wrong idea of God. So here's what we're going to do. Here's what we're going to do in Micah chapter 3. If you flip over your bulletin, look at the back of it, you'll see two kind of big ideas, two main points. These are going to be our tent pegs, if you will. This is how we're going to organize our thoughts this morning. We're going to talk first about the doom of injustice, because I do have that good news for you. Same good news I shared with you last week. Injustice will not have the final word. It will be dealt with. And so we're going to talk about that, the doom of injustice, and we're going to see the dawn of justice itself. So let's talk about it this morning. First, let's see the doom of injustice. Follow along. I'm going to read Micah 3, verses 1 through 3. This is what the word of God says. And I said, "Hear now, heads of Jacob and rulers of the house of Israel, is it not for you to know justice, you who hate God and love evil, who tear off their skin from them and their flesh from their bones, who eat the flesh of my people and strip off their skin from them and break their bones and chop them up as for the pot and as meat in a kettle?" You didn't know that's what you were going to be hearing in church this morning, did you? That's pretty intense, right? But this is how Micah describes the leadership of Judah in his day. He saw unjust rulers. He saw leaders who, although they have a responsibility to administer justice, were in fact turning a blind eye to it. They're supposed to know justice. They're supposed to hate evil and love good. But instead, he tells us in verse 2 that they were doing the opposite. They were loving evil and hating good. In fact, as you read the way they're described there, it makes you think he's talking about some kind of strange cannibalism or something. You're tearing their skin off of their bones and cooking them in pots and things. What's going on? What's Micah talking about? Well, you have to understand, of course, that one of the most common metaphors for leadership in Israel and in most ancient cultures was the metaphor of the shepherd. Just as the shepherds shepherded their flock, So the leaders were supposed to lead their flocks. In fact, that's where scepters come from. I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of kings with scepters in their hands. That tradition of scepters, that's a derivation from the shepherd's crook that they held. In ancient cultures, shepherds were always seen as a metaphor for the leaders. Leaders were the shepherds of their people. And so Micah is taking that metaphor, that image, and he's saying, you leaders, you're supposed to be the shepherds of your people, but instead you're doing this. You're eating the people. You're eating the flock. You're not shepherding the flock. You're not feeding the flock. You're not caring for their wounds. You're eating them. You're shearing them. You're getting profit from them. You're cooking them and eating them. You're fleecing them. You're gaining your good from them. You're preying upon them. In fact, they're not acting like shepherds at all, are they? They're acting like butchers. And Micah condemns them for this. In fact, we could even take it a step further and say they're not just acting like butchers, they're not acting like people at all. They're acting like wolves, aren't they? These are the people who are supposed to shepherd the flock, but they are wolves or lions or bears. They're animals, they're predators who are preying on the flock. It makes me think of something I heard from a pastor named Tabidi Anyabwile. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's a preacher, church planter in Washington, D.C. area. He's talking about this idea of wolves in sheep's clothing. Okay, and he says, there's one major way that you can always tell a sheep from a wolf in sheep's clothing. And that's by what they eat. You can tell a sheep from a wolf by what they eat. I mean, think about it. The sheep grazes, eats grass, but the wolf eats the sheep, That's how you can tell the difference between the true shepherds of God's people and those who are preying on them. What are they consuming? What is filling them up? What are they living on? What do they live for? Who are they preying upon? Michael looked at the leaders of his people, the rulers and the prophets, and he saw them feeding off of the people rather than shepherding them. But they're not going to have the last word. And so in verse 4, Micah details their judgment. He says, "Then they will cry out to the Lord, but he will not answer them. Instead, he will hide his face from them at that time because they have practiced evil deeds." God will punish their oppression by withholding his presence from them in time of need. So I was trying to think about how to convey this idea in a way that would be sufficiently horrific to us, as it was meant to be for Micah's first hearers, and I don't know how to do it, all right? Because as we read that, we think, what's the big deal, right? God says, I'm going to punish you leaders, I'm going to punish you rulers and prophets by taking my presence and my words from you. I'm going to withhold my presence from you. And we hear that and we go, I don't get it. That doesn't seem like much of a punishment to me. What he should do is come and say, I'm going to smash you, I'm going to crush you, I'm going to destroy you. Like that we would get. That type of punishment, that speaks to us. But this, we're kind of going, eh. You know, and many of us are saying to ourselves, I've lived most of my life without God. So God's going to withhold himself from these people. What's the big deal? How is that a punishment? And I don't really, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how to convey this except to say that every good thing, every pleasure that we have in life, every even mildly satisfying thing that we have in this life, we can enjoy because of God's presence, because of God's blessing. And apart from God's gracious, merciful presence and blessing in this life, we have no joy. You can choose to believe that or not, but it's the simple truth. Okay. Apart from the presence of God, those things which we think satisfy us are not even a little bit satisfying. Apart from the gracious presence of God, the things that we think quench our thirst turn to sawdust in our mouths. God's presence is the key to all joy. And so here, when he says, I will withhold myself from them, I will not be there when they call to me, this is the worst judgment that he can possibly give. And in fact, throughout the Old Testament, this is actually a kind of a common theme. God says, I will punish you by withholding myself or withholding my word. In Amos, in another one of the minor prophets, God says, I'm going to send a famine on the land, not a famine of bread, but a famine of my word. I wonder, would we notice a famine like that? That's a judgment from God. That's God leaving people to the horror of their sin. And it's judgment. And God says this is what he's going to do to these false shepherds, these false prophets who are leading his people astray, who are preying upon them, feeding on them. He's going to take himself away from them and leave them utterly alone, utterly destitute. And that's the destiny not just of these unjust rulers, but it's also the destiny of the lying prophets. Look at what he goes on to say in the verses that come next, verses 5, 6, 7. He says, thus says the Lord concerning the prophets who lead my people astray. When they have something to bite with their teeth, they cry peace. But against him who puts nothing in their mouths, they declare holy war. These false prophets are the ones who are propping up these terrible rulers. The rulers are fleecing the people, but they're being undergirded religiously by these false prophets. And Micah says, you false prophets, you'll say whatever it takes to fill your bellies, to get what you need. As long as people feed you, you tell them what they want to hear. And you pronounce God's judgment against those who say anything to the contrary. You know what that amounts to for these prophets? They're lying. They're claiming to represent God, but they're putting lies in God's mouth. And friends, God takes that deeply seriously. Therefore, verse 6, it will be night for you without vision, darkness for you without divination. The sun will go down on the prophets, and the day will become dark over them. The seers will be ashamed. The diviners will be embarrassed. Indeed, they will all cover their mouths because there is no answer from God. God says, in essence, he's going to do the same thing to these false prophets that he did with the false leaders. I'm going to leave you alone. I'm going to walk away. I'm going to take my presence from you. You're going to have no visions. But the implication here in Micah is that it's not just going to be that he won't give them any vision. It's that everybody will see them exposed as frauds. Everybody will know that they have received no vision from the Lord. Everybody will see them for what they are, and they will be humiliated and ashamed. So the essence of what Micah is saying here is that that injustice that he sees in his land will not be the final word. That's not going to be the end. Micah says the days are coming when these prophets and these leaders are going to be shown for what they are. They're going to be revealed. They're going to be punished. We can take heart from that. Injustice will not triumph forever. And I think just as Micah saw hope in that and he gave this message as hope for his people, we can take hope in that too because we see the same types of injustice, don't we? We also have leaders who oppress. We also have religious leaders who lie. We also have people who will say whatever it takes to get what they want. We see injustice in our world too. And we also, like the people in Micah's day, could wonder, when's it going to end? How is it going to end? These are the people in power. How can these strong people be thrown down? And Micah says there's someone stronger still. Their doom will come. Their doom will come. This is the doom of injustice. But Micah doesn't leave it there. He doesn't only talk about how the unjust will meet their end. He also talks about how justice will rise. He talks about the dawn of justice. I probably shouldn't have had it titled The Dawn of Justice, but I figured last week, since I talked about how I like superhero movies, I would just leave it that way. I'm not going to go deeper down that rabbit hole, but there it is. The dawn of justice. Micah talks about it. Look how he says it in verse 8. This translation says, on the other hand, some of your translations are going to say, but as for me, I am filled with power, with the Spirit of the Lord, and with justice and courage to make known to Jacob his rebellious act, even to Israel his sin. Micah is inspired and empowered by the Holy Spirit to proclaim the true message of God. And look at what it says he's inspired and empowered with. He's inspired by the Spirit, but he's empowered with three things. He's empowered with power and with justice and with courage, which I think you'll agree are the very things that would be needed to confront an unjust power structure. If the leaders of Israel were not going to see to justice, Micah says, it's up to me to do it. I've been imbibed with power from God to do justice, to speak for justice, and I've been given courage and power to do it. I think there's a lesson there for us, brothers and sisters. I think as we look at the world around us and we see that our leaders have failed to stand for justice, what that means for us is that we need to. It's our job as God's people to speak up for justice. Justice for those who are marginalized. Justice for those who are discriminated against. That's our job as the people of God. That is our mandate. We too, like Micah, to some lesser extent, but in the same way, have been filled with power from on high. We have been filled with the Spirit of God so that we can speak with power and courage for the sake of justice. Micah is inspired in this particular way, that when he stands for justice, the way it's going to look like is speaking the truth, even when it's uncomfortable. For Micah, standing for justice meant decrying the sins of the culture. He says in verse 8 that he is going to make known to Jacob his rebellious act, even to Israel his sin. And if we remember back in the last chapter, one of the things that was going on in Micah's day is that his fellow prophets, the false prophets, whom he denounces here, they were telling him, don't speak, don't prophesy, don't say these things that you're saying. Micah had pressure on himself not to speak the things that he felt called to speak, but he's going to speak it anyway. He's going to speak truth to power. That's the cliche in our day. Speak truth to power. That's what Micah's going to do. He's going to tell the leaders, he's going to tell the false prophets, what is wrong, the sin that they're committing.
And that can be hard, can't it? That can be as hard for us as it is for Micah to speak the truth. And sometimes we get misunderstood when we speak the truth, but we have to do it. We have to point out the sin in our culture, but we have to do it in a way that it proceeds from a place of love rather than a place of hatred. And that's, I think that's where it gets difficult. That's where we as Christians often go astray. We like the idea sometimes of speaking truth, but we often get, you know, we get into the morass of speaking it in from a place of hatred, where we are angry at the world and we're calling out everything that's wrong, and all the world sees is anger and vitriol. But that's not what we're called to do. We're called to speak the truth, to point out what's wrong, what's sinful in our culture. We're called to point out the injustice in our culture, but we do it from a place of love. So I guess the question for us is, do we love our world? Do we love our country? Do we love our culture enough to speak the truth? Can I tell you, one of the things that frustrates me most about where our country is right now is that anybody who criticizes any institution is seen as opposed to that institution. Do you know what I mean? So let me give you an example. Last summer, on the heels of some of the shootings that had happened where police officers had shot unarmed black men, and there was a lot of protests going on and things like that, I preached a sermon at the church that we came from where I said, look, we as Christians need to stand for justice. And if there is injustice happening, we need to support those who are vulnerable. And I was preaching along these lines, and we had people who were very upset because they perceived what I was saying as being non-supportive of the police, as though to criticize a problem in an institution is the same as not supporting that institution. That's ridiculous. Brothers and sisters, love sees the truth and speaks it. If we live in a place where we cannot see flaws and point them out so that things can get better, we're fooling ourselves. That frustrates me. I hope it frustrates you about our culture. If we love America, we will be willing to say what's wrong with America. Can we just do away with this notion that loving America means constantly towing a party line or saying that everything is good when it isn't? To support the police means not to say that the police are always right. It says, I support the police and I value them for what they do. But we need to make sure that we're protecting rights as much as possible, right? Whose toes are hurting right now? You guys upset yet? If you're not upset yet, give me a few more weeks. We'll get there, okay? We'll get there. Micah is speaking truth to power. And the form that takes for Micah is saying what's wrong in Israel. So that's what he does in verses 9, 10, 11. Here's what he says. Hear this, heads of the house of Jacob and rulers of the house of Israel, who abhor justice and twist everything that's straight, who build Zion with bloodshed and Jerusalem with violent injustice. Her leaders pronounce judgment for a bribe, her priests instruct for a price, and her prophets divine for money. Yet they lean on the Lord, saying, is not the Lord in our midst? Calamity will not come upon us. So here's Micah's indictment. Here's Micah speaking up for justice. He's declaiming the injustice in his culture. And the gist of his charge is that all of the leaders of Judah and of Israel were doing what they do for money. I mean, that's what it amounts to. Prophets, priests, kings. He mentions all three here, and they're all doing what they do for money, for what they can get. And he says, this is wrong. This is why there's trouble. But in the midst of all of that, in the midst of the horror that was Judah and Israel in Micah's day, he says, yet they claim a kind of faith. They lean on the Lord, saying, is not the Lord in our midst? Calamity will not come upon us. So remember, the people of Judah had as their capital Jerusalem, right? With the Temple of Solomon at its pinnacle. And they saw themselves as the people of God. We're the people of God. We're chosen by God. Abraham is our father, our ancestor. This is Jerusalem. This is the city of David that God gave to us. This is the Temple of Solomon where Yahweh, the Lord, is worshipped and his sacrifices are made. Nothing bad can happen to us. That's what they're saying. They were ignoring all of their moral failures and saying God will not possibly judge us because we're God's people. This is God's city. This is God's temple. Nothing bad can happen. Does that sound like a right view of God to you? It isn't. It isn't a right view of God. They were looking at God the same way that the pagans looked at their gods. That's how the pagans thought about their little gods, that they would protect their homeland simply because they were tied to it. Yahweh makes no promise to his people that's not tied to their obedience. It says they lean on the Lord. Isn't that interesting? There in verse 11, yet they lean on the Lord, saying, is not the Lord in our midst? You see, that word lean, have you heard that before in the Old Testament? That's one of the, it's a popular word for Old Testament writers to describe faith. Remember Proverbs? Trust in the Lord with all your might and lean not on your own understanding. Remember that? You can do a word study on the word lean in the Old Testament and see all the times that it's used as a way of describing faith. What Micah is saying is, yes, these false leaders, these false rulers, they have a faith of a sort. They're leaning on a God, but the God they're leaning on isn't the real one. The God they think they have faith in is not the God of Israel. He's not the God of the Bible. He's not the true God. He's a God of their own imaginations. And I think this illustrates a good point for us too, because we live in a culture that makes faith itself an end in itself, that makes spirituality an end in itself. As long as you have faith, that's what matters. As long as you have spirituality, that's what matters. No, it doesn't. If your faith is in the wrong object, it's worthless. That's harsh, I know, but it's the truth. If your faith is in the wrong object, it's worthless. We opened up a bank account this week, and had a nice conversation with the lady at the bank, and so of course as I was opening up the account and talking about our move here, and I was talking about being a pastor of a church, and she asked me how I got into that, and so we were talking about church, and we're talking about the Bible and things, and the gospel, and I was sharing with her I became a pastor because I'm excited about the gospel. I get excited about what Jesus has done for us, And she kind of smiled the way people do when they're being polite, but they aren't really interested, you know. But she asked the question, so. But we're talking about it, so I asked her, do you go to church anywhere? What are your thoughts about all this? And she said, well, I grew up in church, but it didn't really stick with me. That was the phrase she used. It didn't really stick with me. But she said, and here's why I think it's interesting. But I say my prayers every night. And she emphasized that little word, my. I say my prayers every night. And the impression I got was, she's not interested in church, but she has kind of her spirituality. And I don't know anything about her. We're hoping to get to know her better. So I'm not saying anything about her at all, but I think that perfectly describes our culture that says it doesn't matter what you believe, as long as you have your spirituality, as long as you have your faith, that's what matters. And Micah says that's ridiculous. It's faith in the wrong God that leads to the kinds of abuses that Micah decries in this chapter. It's because the prophets and the priests and the kings thought of God the wrong way that led them to treat people the wrong way. Do you see the connection between them? If you think that God is a God who's going to take care of you no matter what, then it doesn't matter how you treat people. And so the kings and the prophets and the priests, they abused their power. And they fleeced the people, they ate them, they stripped the skin from their bones, so to speak, and they lined their own pockets. The wrong view of God will always produce the wrong treatment of people. All right? And so we circle back to our main idea. The wrong view of God, which is what the people had, will always produce the wrong treatment of people. Therefore, the only way to decisively correct the treatment of people is to correct our view of God. All right, look at the last verse of the chapter. Here's what God says he's going to do. Therefore, on account of you, Zion will be plowed as a field. Jerusalem will become a heap of ruins. And the mountain of the temple will become high places of a forest. You understand? The people were saying, God will never desert us because this is Jerusalem, his city. This is his temple. And Micah says, God's going to destroy it all. You think God has your back because you live in Jerusalem and you worship at the temple. God's going to destroy it all because of the way you treat other people. Because of your moral abuses. Brothers and sisters, listen to me carefully. We all have our idols, right? For the people that Micah was addressing, their idol was their city and their temple and their false view of God. But we all have our idols too, right? We have our wrong way of thinking about God. I don't know what yours is, but we all have them. And just as God says to them, I'm going to wipe out Jerusalem, he says to us, I will destroy those idols. This is what the Bible means when it says God is a jealous God. He will not brook any rivals. And he does it for our good. He will wipe out your idols so that you can see him clearly, because he's the only one worth seeing. He will take away every other object of your worship so that you can worship him, because he's the only one worth worshiping. This is what God says he will do in ancient Israel, and this is what he says he will do for us as well. So, the wrong view of God always produces the wrong treatment of people. So as long as we have a wrong view of God, we will continue to have a wrong view of and a wrong treatment of others. And so I want to suggest to you this morning that as we look at our world around us and as we see the injustice around us, we must do several things. We must indeed fight for justice. We must be those who advocate for laws and things that protect the vulnerable and that uphold justice and that fight injustice. We need to do that absolutely. But at the same time, we need to realize that the final correction of injustice will not come about until people's hearts are changed and they view God correctly. They view God for who he is. So our last question as we wrap things up this morning is, how does that happen? What hope is there of a final demise of injustice? What hope is there for a final establishment of true justice? As you get used to me preaching, you'll be able to tell that when I start flipping to the other side of the book, you know we're about at the end of the sermon. Okay? When we get to the New Testament, you know we're about done. All right? The problem of injustice will not be finally corrected until our view of God is corrected, which is why when Jesus comes and begins his ministry, he opens up the prophet Isaiah and he reads words that are remarkably similar to the words of Micah. We read them earlier in our service. Jesus, at the beginning of his ministry, read this from Isaiah: "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set free those who are oppressed, and to proclaim the favorable year of the Lord." Jesus comes precisely for this reason, to correct our view of God, to change the way we think of God, so that we learn to see God for who he is, a God of justice, a God of morality, a God of grace, a God of forgiveness, a God of liberty to prisoners. And of course, Jesus shows that finally in himself, doesn't he? He shows that by himself enduring the worst injustice, so that we can one day stand before God and be declared just. And don't miss that. Don't miss the wonder of that. Because we stand before God not as those whose sins are swept under the carpet. Right? That would be unjust as well. We stand before God as those who are righteous in God's sight. And because of what Jesus did, God is just in proclaiming us righteous. You see? I want you to take a minute and think about this. Think about what God has done for you in Christ. Think about the justice that God produces through Jesus Christ, his Son. Give thanks to him. We're just going to take a minute in silent thought and reflection as you do that. Pray by yourselves and think about it and give thanks to God. And then after just a moment of silent reflection, we'll wrap things up this morning with a final hymn.